For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
It's time to open the door and get on the floor and walk the dinosaurs.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
You stood on the shoulders of geniuses to accomplish something as fast as you could, and before you even knew what you had, you patented it and packaged it and slapped it on a plastic lunchbox, and now you're selling it. You want to sell it. Well,
I don't think you're giving us our due credit. Our scientists have done things which nobody's ever done before.
Yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
Hello, everybody. It's Wreckatopia, episode 155. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Jeremy Scott.
Why did the music stop early? That was bizarre. I didn't like it.
I don't know. I didn't have the same thing, I don't think. Also joined by Aaron Dicer.
Tidally-ho, Amberinos.
Amberinos. Also, we are joined by chat, who are here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Today's big recommend is Jurassic Park, probably the biggest movie we have ever talked about on this podcast. Let's start off with some small recommends.
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
And Aaron, why don't you kick us off?
Will do. I'm just going to talk about The Pit. This is a new show on Max. It is rightfully being called ER meets 24. It takes place during one day at an emergency room in Pittsburgh. Noah Wiley, who may also be associated with ER because he was on that show, is at the center of this incredible cast. I asked my wife, who is a nurse now, if this is something she'd be interested in watching together. And I'm so glad I did because it's become our show. And it's so fun watching with her because she has been blown away by how accurate it is with the stuff it's talking about and the words that they're using. And it doesn't feel dumbed down to her. You know, like a lot of times they'll have to dumb the stuff down for the layman, but you're getting all of the information even if you don't understand the words they're using, which I really, really like. It is incredible to me how many different stories we're following every hour of this show. So each episode takes place during an hour of this day where a lot of these different things are happening.
Oh, so like the whole season's a single day? I thought each episode was a day.
Okay. No, the season is 15 hours of the same day. So 15 episodes, an hour each. We are through episode 5 or 6. I think there are 10 out. They come out weekly on Max. And man, this show is good. Noah Wiley is incredible. There's enough like new stuff, new stories, new characters that are coming into the ER each episode. And also these overarching what's happening on this day with some of the characters. It's just good TV. It's just really good TV. So highly recommend it.
Yeah, I've heard some good things about this. In the chat, JC's talking about a doctor who's gushing over the show, saying this is like one of the first times it's super accurate. Mm-hmm. interested in watching this.
Yeah, it's
really good. What's crazy is when ER came on, when ER started, my mom would watch it, and she was a nurse all her life. And she said a lot of the same things about ER. Like, this show, like, that's actually what you would do in that situation, even though it seems extreme. Or she was constantly praising how accurate the medical stuff was on ER. And I can only imagine The Pit is 10 times more accurate and more realistic today. But, of course, Michael Crichton was a doctor, and he helped create ER. So it's not super surprising that there was a focus on that. Anyway, I'll have to check this out. I like Noah Wiley a lot.
Yeah, and the chat is correct. I think there is a lawsuit actually going on with the Crichton estate because they're saying it's too much like ER, using the same person and that kind of stuff. But it's so different. I mean, just the real time aspect of it alone should be enough to distinguish.
Does Noah Wiley all the time say, "Damn it, Chloe"?
No, I haven't heard it once.
It's like, it's just, oh, because you had Noah Wiley in it, that's the reason why like ER. I mean, you might as well sue all the medical shows at this point if that's the case. If it's just, I mean, not the fact that Noah Wiley isn't in every medical show, but I'm just saying that
he should be.
If that's the only grounds that you have, then every medical show has stuff that's probably in ER.
Chicago Hope came out the same year ER did. Did they sue Chicago Hope?
Yeah, exactly. I'll go ahead and do my small recommend. It's a movie from 1973, much like last week. It's The Last of Sheila, a movie that was written by Anthony Perkins and Stephen Sondheim, of all people. this is a murder mystery. It's kind of got the setup of a lot of these. Someone invites a bunch of friends to a house or acquaintances to a house. This time this is James Coburn, is inviting a whole bunch of his friends to a boat that he is called Sheila after his wife who died a year previous she was walking along a path and a car hit her, and he's invited all these people to come out and play a game, and it seems innocuous at first. Basically, everybody's given a card that has, you know, hey, you are this and you are that, and basically everybody has to do on one night, they have to figure out which clue is leading to what person. And just because a person has a card, then they start thinking that, a lot of these people start thinking that the cards have more to do with personal things than actual gameplay or whatever. So a lot of people are like, one of them is called you are a shoplifter. Well, there's actually a character in the movie who was convicted of shoplifting, but they don't necessarily have the card. So they start thinking maybe this is more personal than just an actual game that they're playing. On the second night, James Coburn is murdered, and they have to basically dissect what he was trying to get at with the game and who possibly could have killed him over it, considering there's a lot of personal information being shared on these cards, and they do believe that he was doing that as a point and was trying to point the finger at the person who hit his wife and killed her on the night that she died. So it's a lot of that going on. There's a really tremendous cast in this. Richard Benjamin, Diane Cannon, Raquel Welch, James Mason is in this. A lot of really good actors are in this. Ian McShane, who I don't think I had seen anything in before what was the show that he was in?
Deadwood?
Deadwood. Yeah, I don't think I had ever seen him in anything before that. The young Ian McShane is in this. So if you love murder mystery movies, I love how this one plays out. Lots of twists and turns to it. Just a really fun watch. Really fun movie.
Excellent.
Well, we all have stories.
I love that you're exploring the 70s or the early 70s, because it's exposing me to things like, I've never heard of this thing. But it's got a lot of people in it I know, so
Now well, this is apparently a favorite of John. This is a favorite of Jonathan's. He apparently went to go see this on the big screen recently, and I stumbled on this because it was in a list of movies that, like, this is what this director, this director has 10 movies you've never seen that you want to, and so I wrote it down and basically just ordered all these movies on Blu-ray. Because I think you can only get this one on VOD. You can only, but anyway, it's well worth it. It's a really fun thing, especially if you love, murder mystery stuff, especially in the '70s where they're like really like hitting this category hard for, you know, for a while. So anyway, there you go.
Yeah.
Nice. My small recommend this week, like Aaron, is a television show. And like Aaron, it's one I'm watching with my wife. It is Shrinking on Apple TV Plus Max. Minus.
Yes.
We're only two episodes into the first season, but I already love this show. Much like Man on the Inside, it is making me laugh out loud and then also making me feel feelings. At this point, I'm ready to admit Jason Segel is just one of my very favorite people to watch do anything. I think it's why I like Forgetting Sarah Marshall so much. I think it's why I like Freaks and Geeks more than I should have. I think it's why I like that Muppet movie more than I should. He's just, I love him. He's charming. He's everyman-ish enough, but also charming and handsome enough. You can understand why girls in movies fall for him. And he plays a therapist. His boss is Harrison Ford, another therapist. Harrison Ford is in, well, the character is in full don't give a fuck mode, say whatever the hell I want, and it's awesome. And Jason Segel's psychologist character, his wife had died a year ago, and he's just in a funk. And to break out of the funk, he starts telling his patients what to do instead of just being a therapist and letting them guide themselves to their own conclusions. He tells a woman to leave her husband. He takes an angry kid who keeps getting fights to an MMA gym, breaking all of these rules of psychiatry, and yet experiencing some success both in coming out of his funk and in helping these people. And unless the show completely fumbles it moving forward, which I doubt, because this is from the guy who created and show ran Scrubs, and there's another one. Ted Lasso. Spin City. So there's a great track record here. And I really like the side characters, most of whom I don't think I've seen in a lot of stuff. There's a female coworker of his. I'm not sure if I've ever seen her in anything. If I did, I don't recognize her. And she's great.
Jessica Williams?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. I think so. Because she was on The Daily Show. That was where she was.
Yeah, Jessica Williams.
Yeah.
Anyway, two thumbs up so far. Hopefully we're going to watch another episode or two today. And there are two seasons out now. It's already been renewed for a third. There you go.
I've only seen one episode of this. Not that it didn't attract me or anything, but I saw one and I just haven't picked it up. And I really enjoyed that first episode. So I would say it's I didn't realize it. Isn't it the third season at this point?
Two are down. They ordered
two
it.
Two are down.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It had gone on longer than I thought it had. I think people really picked it up on that second season, and that's where I started hearing about it.
Yeah.
Most.
I've watched both seasons and love this show. I'm so glad you're watching it. I have been very curious as to your thoughts about it, especially knowing like how straightforward you are about therapy and you know those kind of things, and how movies and TV shows handle it. But man, I just think this show is hilarious and poignant. And Liz and Derek, the neighbor couple, is just one of my favorite couples on TV. That's Krista Miller and Ted McGinley playing that couple.
McGinley, I've only seen two episodes, but every time he speaks, he's sarcastically talking about how he's taking care of something that Jason Segel should be taking care of every single time. Just walking the dog, I didn't want.
Yeah. It is full of that stuff. Luke Tenney, I don't know that you've met his character Sean yet. I can't remember how early that character, maybe there in the first couple episodes. Recently in Nickel Boys, had a part in Nickel Boys as well, and I just really enjoyed him in this show. Then you've got like Heidi Gardner, who you may know from SNL, popping in as one of the clients. Like, it's just there's always somebody interesting and always something to laugh at. Yeah, this is a great recommend.
All right. It's time to open the door and get on the floor and walk the dinosaur. Let's get on to our big recommend.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. Real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Aaron, take it away.
Sure. Jurassic Park is Steven Spielberg's second best film of 1993 and the bane of all CG movie moments for the next 30 years. It's the ultimate why can't you be like your older brother JP of the film graphics history. It also dominated that summer with over $350 million earned, which was over 8 times as much as the other Dangerous Animals on the Loose movie that year, Homeward Bound: The Incredible Journey. But on to the synopsis. God creates dinosaurs. God destroys dinosaurs. God creates man. Man destroys God. Man creates dinosaurs. Dinosaurs eat man. Woman inherits the earth. And that's Jurassic Park. Jeremy, what did you think?
I'm just
kidding, not kidding. That is kind of the synopsis of the movie. But let's do this for real. The movie also starts with a fake out, as apparently the machinery carting crates have to destroy half the forest like it's a giant T-Rex in order to get there. We're at Isla Nublar, and Robert Muldoon is trying to transfer something vicious from a crate to a pen, but apparently without a functioning docking lock. The result is a perfect example of how you launch a movie with an exciting cold open without resorting to starting in medias res. We then cut to an amber mine where Hammond has stood up his lawyer Gennaro, who may be snivelly but is making a lot of sense, complaining about not enough inspections. We'll also learn that Hammond is a dig to mosquitoes, but more on that later. Meanwhile, a different digger is dusting off the power of boneyards in the Badlands. We join Sam Neill and Laura Dern as Alan Grant and Ellie Sattler, using some newfangled LIDAR to find skeletons and an old-fangled dino finger to give a child nightmares for the rest of his life. Because, watch out, it's the claw! The claw's gonna get you. As Alan and Ellie debate the merits of the kid's sin, Hammond arrives in a helicopter to steal some champagne from the fridge and invite them to come to his mysterious island. And by invite, I mean bribe. Next up, we see a clandestine meeting between Dennis Nedry and learn he didn't have the strength and integrity of Charlie Bucket and has decided to sell the chocolate recipe to Slugworth. Also, it may be sad, but indeed, nobody cares about Dotson. And we're off to the island. We join the crew in a helicopter that's flying so close to the water that it looks like it must be a boat from the window view. We meet Jeff Goldblum's Ian Malcolm, who is a chaotician, which was not then nor ever has been a thing. Then the Jurassic Park theme kicks in and John Williams buys some polish for another Oscar for best score. It will still come in handy even when the score somehow doesn't even get nominated, because he will eventually win for the other Spielberg movie anyway. They land, and after a short Jeep ride, Alan Grant cries some tears because animals sometimes move together in formation or something. They make their way to the Welcome Center and check out the expositional intro ride. They find out what was up with the amber mosquitoes earlier, and what was it? Bingo! Dino DNA. The crew then breaks the ride so they can get a better look at the incubation room, and we get a look at a dino hatching while Hammond makes the absurd claim that he's been there for every single one of these things.
Yeah.
We also find out that the island dinos are like my sister's clubhouse. No boys allowed. Also, when they find out Hammond is creating raptors, they have a cow about it and then promptly use a crane to feed that cow to the raptors. Over dinner, there's a fabulous conversation about the moral and natural conundrums involved in this venture because the movie spares no intelligence. We exit, and hey, Hammond's kids are here. Huh, there will be no regrets. We hear a storm might be coming.
Those are his grandkids.
Yes, they are his grandkids, correct.
I thought you said kids.
I did say kids. I have typed grandkids, but I think I said kids, yes.
Ooh.
We hear a storm might be coming, and after Sam Jackson requires us to engage in some self-gluteal squeezes, we are on to the tour. The tour rovers past the Dilophosaur pen with no action other than some road signs about keeping the windows up so you don't get death spit on you. And wait, are the windows controlled by the attendees? The T-Rex also gets stage fright, even with a goat dinner on the line. So instead, we continue on with Ian giving a very skeezy explanation of chaos theory and Grant bailing when he sees something in the field. Turns out he has Triceratops radar, so they can attempt to diagnose it by digging through some dino dung. The storm begins to kick up, and Nedry has to turn up his espionage timetable, so he heads out for a Coke and a Barbasol. But of course, the program he set to shut down security so he can snag some embryos will have consequences throughout the park that sets chaos into motion from theory into reality. First up, the vehicles have stopped by the T-Rex paddock, where little Timmy finds some night vision goggles that apparently must be expensive because they're heavy, I guess. And that's how weight works in relation to cost. Didn't know that. Yep. Oh, and we get our first lesson in impact tremors and the ripple effect. The T-Rex is now joining the show. With that happening, Gennaro makes a bathroom run, and Lex finds a light that unfortunately attracts the movement-aware T-Rex. And sorry, I stopped typing there for about 10 minutes. Was that the greatest action scene in cinematic history? Because I think it just might be the greatest action scene in cinematic history. Anyway, Hammond asks Muldoon to bring back his grandchildren, and Ellie goes with because why the heck not? Nedry now has wrecked his Jeep around the Dilophosaurs area, and he finds out exactly how full of spit they are. We then have to get Timmy out of the tree and back in the car again. Ellie and Muldoon have to rescue Malcolm, but can't find Grant and the kids. But when the T-Rex shows up again, they get a lesson in automobile safety and checking all your mirrors. Then it's back to Alan, Timmy, and Vegasaurus Lex, who are now back in a tree again. Hammond and Ellie have a conversation about flea circuses and reality, and the tree crew wakes up to a long neck invading their space and make a discovery that frog DNA has indeed helped life find a way. The crew back at Dino HQ decide the only way to clear Nedry's virus is to do a full reset, which works, except they need to flip the breakers that are apparently on the other side of the compound. Nick Fury goes out to reset them but never comes back, so Ellie and Muldoon decide to go make it happen themselves. As Alan takes the kid over an electric fence, Ellie makes a run for the breaker room. Will the kids get all the way over and off of the fence before Ellie restarts the power? Oh, the tension! The answer is surprisingly no, and little Timmy dies as he's fried on the fence.
Yep. Yes, he is. Yep.
The end.
The end. Wait, he survives 10,000 volts? Okay, fine. I guess humans have survived that much before. As long as we get to see Muldoon go full Muldoon and be the badass he is in the book and not get taken out like a chump who didn't even know he was being hunted. Well, dang it. The kids and Grant make it back to the Welcome Center, where Grant goes out to grab Ellie while leaving the kids to eat some Jell-O and fend for themselves by playing hide-and-seek with a couple of velociraptors in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. They lock one in the freezer, and then the other one chases them to the control room. Thankfully, Lex has that big Unix energy and manages to navigate the inefficient 3D UI to eventually get the door locked and all the systems back up and running. Unfortunately, the raptor comes through the glass, forcing the crew to climb through the ventilation system. Come out to the island. We'll get together. Have a few laughs. Grant muses as the four humans and one raptor eventually crash through onto the hanging dino skeleton, becoming one big mobile of death. And just when the two remaining raptors seem to have them pinned against a wall, a little Tyrannosaurus Rex Machina gives Hammond enough time to pull up his rover and get the remaining survivors to a helicopter. And then the movie just ends. Just like that. Doesn't even wrap up whether or not the Triceratops even fully recovered. Because you could just end movies in the 90s, apparently, so that's what they did. Imagine that. Mm-hmm. And that is Jurassic Park. What did you guys think this time through? Jeremy?
This movie looks great in 4K, which is how I happened to watch it for this viewing. And I gotta be honest, there was a little voice inside of me that says, you could probably fake your notes here. You've seen this movie enough. You could probably, if you don't have the time. And man, I'm glad that that voice was drowned out by the movie lover in me, because every time we do a movie for this show, even if it's one I've seen 30 times like Jurassic Park, I see things and hear things that I would not have otherwise. Like, prepping for this show helped me put on a specific kind of hat that ultimately helps me appreciate movies more than I thought possible. So the biggest thing that I came away with in this movie is the fact that it's 30 plus years old and it still gives me goosebumps, a sense of wonder and awe. And I think it's both the Stan Winston, the Spielberg visuals, but I think it's John Williams' score. It's my second favorite John Williams score. But I really think more than a lot of movies, the score is a huge part of what you feel in this movie. And I love how the music navigates the wonder into the terror, and there's still some wonder in there. So John Williams was the big hero for me coming out of the movie. There's a few, I got a bunch of notes, but there's a few that I definitely want to get to if you guys don't mind.
No, I do not.
I love the way this movie foreshadows, and I didn't always notice and appreciate it, but as they're getting in the Jeeps, you can faintly hear a radio. The subtitles tell you that it's a voice saying everyone must be at the docks by 1900 for departure. And then the first exhilarant is the Dilophosaurus, which ends up killing Nedry on his way to the docks. Like, the movie puts all the pieces there ahead of time so that when the events happen, they make perfect sense. I love the Nedry scene. One of my favorite line readings of all time is when he insults that dinosaur and says, "No wonder you're extinct. I'm going to run you over when I come back down." It's just hysterical. I remember being creeped out by the velociraptors opening that door to get into the kitchen. It's less creepy now that two of my cats can open those exact same kind of doors. And I don't know if that says more about my cats or the velociraptors. I paid a lot more attention to Hammond and what he was saying in the context of how I view billionaires today. And there's a line where he's yelling at Nedry, and the book goes into this more about Nedry's gambling and not getting paid what he thinks he's worth. The movie just kind of throws it in there. But he says to him, "I don't blame people for their mistakes, but I do ask them to pay for them." And that is such a billionaire thing to say, especially for someone who is not going to pay for his mistakes and will, by the end of this movie, is already planning the next park. Like, it's just, it's really well written. And I didn't always notice that aspect. There's even the part where she says, before they go out, she says, "You have poisonous plants in this building." And he doesn't even bat an eye. Like, the fact that that's not immediately addressed, "Oh, somebody go get that poisonous plant out of here," that's foreshadowing. That's telling you what's going to happen, but also that this billionaire doesn't care. I think when he says spared no expense, this is the first time watching this movie that I feel like there's a complete double meaning there, and it's always been there, but I've just never noticed it. I've just always taken him at face value, spared no expense. But he spared plenty of expenses. He only hired one computer guy to run the entire damn park. He is a penny-pinching billionaire. He spared no expense on the ice cream and the Chilean sea bass, but he spared expenses elsewhere.
Yep.
I love his line reading. Another all-timer when after Malcolm says, eventually you do plan to have dinosaurs on your dinosaur tour. And just, I really hate that, man. Just the way he says that, Attenborough is just a god. I think it's hilarious that they thought they couldn't breed because they were all female, which even in 93 is foolish because there are plenty of species largely in the ocean that literally changed their sex in order to have offspring. I love the idea that Hammond was apparently going to stand up for every single showing of that movie and interact with the cartoon version of himself. He's like, oh, I have lines. And he gets up there like,
yeah.
How many tours a day are you going to be up here doing that you won't have time to be there for all the births if you're doing this?
It's another thing that looks like it's amazing when he's doing it.
Yeah.
But like, it has no forethought to the future whatsoever. It's right. A perfect thing.
Which is, again, a metaphor for, you know, everything that's happening in the movie. Yeah, that's all. Okay, those are all the ones that I highlight. I still have 30 notes, but we can get those.
No, keep going. That's fine. You can get going if you want.
Well, I already said that one. I saw the chat saying that they're glad Hammond was changed to a loving grandfather for the movie. And I think that's correct. This movie kind of, if it wasn't so awesome, it would have pissed me off. I stayed up till 5 a.m. reading this book the day before it came out because I wanted to immerse myself in all. And then the movie has like 15% of the book in it, and
it's very different. Yeah,
does its own thing. There's a scene in the book that I do miss that apparently they planned to shoot but didn't, where Grant and the two kids are floating down a river. And the T-Rex is chasing them in the river, and they come to a waterfall. It's just a really incredible read. And I wish that we had the little bitey compies. They end up showing up in The Lost World. So, you know, I'm not too upset about that. But I do love, in the book, I do think Hammond is perfectly written. I do think the evil Hammond is better for the book, and the loving grandfather Hammond is better for the movie. I didn't understand this time through. I kind of started questioning some of what Malcolm says, even though his chaos theory is the heart of everything happening here. When he lectures him about you didn't earn the knowledge for yourself, I just wrote, isn't that science? Like, aren't all scientists standing on the shoulders of scientists who came before them and learned something? Like, right?
Yeah.
Like, it really stood out to me.
People share their knowledge, and you build off of that knowledge, and that's kind of how that works, yeah.
I mean, I think the heart of his rant is fine. You're a billionaire who swooped in, and you don't know anything about this, but at the same time, it stood out to me huge this time through that Hammond noticeably does not go on the tour himself and is never really in any direct danger. I hate that bastard. as you said, Aaron, the T-Rex assault it's damn near perfect. It's absolutely terrifying.
So good.
And I think I wrote Spielberg has maybe always been a horror director at heart, even in movies that aren't straight up horror, because he does make you feel terror, in that moment. I agree with you that Muldoon is a chump at the end, and I don't like it.
He's so cool in the book. Like, in fact, it was my son came in when I was watching my oldest son, and he was like, I hate this movie. And I was like, you certainly never watched this movie if you hate this movie. And he's like, I couldn't finish it because of what they did to Muldoon. Like, he read the book, and he was just like, and I was like, I'm with you, but this movie exists as its own thing that is amazing out with different characters. That is a different Muldoon than is in the book. So he was like, Muldoon broke that Velociraptor's leg with his bare hands in the book. And I was like, yeah, no, I know. I'm with you.
I also noticed a lot more of the movie playing with gender stereotypes than I had noticed before. In terms of, it's way more than just the two female dinosaurs can't procreate and the seatbelt thing. You've got the dinosaur kills man, woman inherits the earth thing, where, you know, Ellie plays very much against the traditional demure female type. Grant, who doesn't want anything to do with kids and is gruff, but ends up actually being very nurturing and caring to these kids. And I just think the whole movie is talking about our expectations of people versus who they actually are. It's a deeper movie, this watch, than I think I've ever experienced, because I think this show makes me think more deeply. Chris?
The first thing that I wanted to deconstruct that T-Rex thing, and honestly, the entire middle of this movie is the best part of the movie. The entire part of it, where as soon as Nedry shuts off all the systems and then he goes on his thing, that's where John Williams does some music that is not as famous as the theme song, but it's also probably my favorite piece of music that he does in the whole thing. That just that very like conspiratorial, like, you know all that type of stuff, and there's all that going through it and everything. The T-Rex scene is so good because it's just them out in these jeeps or whatever, and then of course the famous water rippling thing, which I think they used a guitar string or something like that to pluck the water and make it ripple and everything like that. That starts it off. And then they look over and they see that they hear the stomping, but then they look over and they see the goat is gone now. Like, this goat, which was boring before because they put the goat down there for the T-Rex to eat, and even the goat was bored and, you know, went lay down on the whatever that rope thing that he was tied to, has now disappeared, and now the thing that was boring has become terrifying in a flash. And of course it goes right to Lex saying, "Where's the goat?" And then a leg of the goat comes on, which I don't understand really. It's really just an announcement from the T-Rex. Like, he was listening in on the dialogue. Why didn't he just eat that whole thing? I don't know. But
he's standing above with the goat leg, just waiting.
His tiny little arm.
Is he gonna say it? Is he gonna say it?
Exactly. And so then it's not, you know, we know that the fences have been turned off, so we see the arm or the claw or whatever touching the fence and realizing there's no danger there. That's where we realize there's some real actual terror about to happen, because the dinosaur realizes that this thing is not electrified anymore and can go right through it if it wants to. And then it's the perspective changing from Lex and Tim's Jeep to Malcolm and Sam Neill's Jeep, because then it's the wires popping off of the fencing that really just like that. That's where he just keeps on putting up the stairs of terror on this thing. And then, yes, finally we see the T-Rex coming out, and it's officially free at this point. And it never really stops. There's always different aspects to what's going on here. They try their best. Jeff Goldblum and Sam Neill try their best to distract the dinosaur from getting away from them. Even after Lex has been shining a light out there and like attracting the dinosaur, and they go through all that stuff. And then this one thing I never understood is that Sam Neill goes out there and he's successfully diverting the T-Rex, and then Malcolm's like, "I've got to do it too." I've never understood that, but he comes out and he's like, "I've got a flare too. Let's, you know."
This is one of my notes. I think we are right to question what Malcolm's thinking, but what the movie's doing there is really interesting. First time I've ever noticed this. Malcolm is becoming chaos theory. In that mm-hmm. moment, something was supposed to go one way, and his little decision, however he made it, all of a sudden, you know, changes things, and he takes it a different way, maybe a more dangerous way, probably a more dangerous way. I just found that interesting that he kind of embodied chaos theory in that moment.
And again, who's to say what we would do in a situation and all that? It's a completely different situation than any human has had to deal with before. But I always thought that was interesting. But like, it's not only just the fact that the T-Rex is attacking them in the car once it's upside down. Mm. He starts spinning it around and all these different things that happen. There is a part that I don't understand when once the Jeep goes over the barrier, like suddenly it's 20-30 feet down, like that's never made sense. Like I've always felt like when you see that T-Rex paddock the first time you see it, the ground is level with it. There's not any like steep ground, there's not any steep drop, but they've put that in there obviously to add even more to this scene, which keeps going and keeps going and keeps going. One of my favorite things during this T-Rex attack, this was my first experience with walking in on crowd reactions as a movie theater usher, was walking in when the lawyer is in the outhouse. That part is just an amazing audience reaction thing, because everybody in that theater who had, you know, this is a time where nobody has seen Jurassic Park, or only a few people have seen Jurassic Park. And that outhouse goes completely, you know, is completely destroyed, and he's just sitting there on the toilet. Everybody is laughing in the theater. Everybody's like, ha 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 ha. And then before you can get that third ha out, T-Rex is biting down on the lawyer. You didn't think that was going to happen at first. You thought he was done, sure, but you didn't think that the T-Rex was going to go, yeah, and just snap him in half and tear him into a million pieces in one shot. So the change of people laughing to going, oh my God, all at once is one of the best things I've ever experienced in a movie theater. And I got to see that a bunch over the year, over the time that it played. I like to, there's like innocuous lines that stuff that I never really gave much credit to or whatever, but I like when they're climbing that fence and they're there's this whole thing, like, I bet I can beat you over to the other side before you get to the top. And Sam Neill's like, it's not a race. Well, it's not a race with you guys. It is a race with you and Laura Dern, unknowingly. That's one of the things that I picked out of this one that I hadn't noticed before. This is a movie I've seen a million times, but I hadn't seen it in forever. And also, Jeremy mentioned the subtitles. Subtitles have been a huge help for me as well for movies and over the years. And I got to really sink my teeth into that whole thing at the beginning. I didn't really register a lot of the stuff that they're talking about. The lawsuit that the guy's family is bringing is a $20 million lawsuit. The reason why he wants to get them out there isn't just to get the safety of the park. It's for them to basically be witnesses for the $20 million lawsuit he doesn't want to spend money on and everything. And I never really caught that it was a bribe until this showing, that he was like, I'll fund your dig for 3 years, which again, he's not really thinking about the future here. Like, I don't understand how, you know, like, once they see what they see, why they're going to care about their dig. In fact, they already know they're done with the dig by the time they're walking up the stairs in the lobby at that one. They're like, I guess we're out of a job. And, you know, Ian Malcolm's like, don't you mean extinct? It's one of those things I've never understood. The other thing is too, a lot of people might watch this movie and go, well, if they just didn't hire somebody like Dennis Nedry, this would have been fine. And I keep thinking about all the expansion that you see during that scene where they're all in the dinner table and they're talking about like whether this is a good thing or not and all this other stuff. You know, you see stuff like Jurassic Park, Tennessee in the background and you see like all these different places that like eventually a something this size is going to run into somebody who is going to wreck all of this. This is exactly what Ian's talking about. I mean, if it worked this time, you would have had, as many times as it got expanded, you would have had all these different people out there who would have been like, I'm not getting paid enough for this job. I'm going to steal the embryos and give it to Dodgson. So, So that's another thing that I love about this movie, that it's sort of, there's a sort of subtext to that where they're talking about, you know, it's not just Dennis Nedry. There's going to be a bunch of Dennis Nedrys out there eventually, because there's going to be so many parks that they're going to fill dinosaurs up with. So that's some stuff that I sort of caught on this viewing that I had not in the many times I had watched it before. There's just a lot of like great suspense moments all the way through this. Like I said, that middle section is the part that really grabs me all the way through. It's just like the time just blows by during that whole section, and I love it. And I saw an interview with Samuel L. Jackson who's like, I'm gonna assert that I'm not dead in this movie. I can always come back to Jurassic Park. He's like, you only saw an arm. There's gonna be a point where I was like, if you wanted to bring me back, I'm just this guy who's been like on the island this whole time with one arm.
That'd be
like,
amazing. This is the same thing about Mace Windu. You never saw me die.
He did say that about Mace Windu too, as well. Yes.
Always good to keep your options open.
Yeah, by the way, that's another thing that, you know, this movie is, it's just on the verge before the smoking bans started and everything. Samuel L. Jackson is smoking like a chimney in this movie, and that was something that when I was working at a movie theater, people would all get in the office and they'd be smoking away, and just like that whole office was just like just smoke when you walked in, and the ceiling tiles were yellow, and you know, just this type of thing. But yeah, man, what a great movie this is. I'm glad to have revisited it.
It's so good.
Yeah, me too.
You guys mentioned a lot of the stuff that I had. I will say, I think this time through, the theme for me was efficiency. This movie is so efficient. I think it's a 2-hour movie. It's not like it's 90 minutes. Like, it's a 2-hour film, but it is an efficient 2 hours. And because of that, it doesn't feel like 2 hours. There's always something happening. I just think how quickly this movie introduces us to everybody, gets us on the island, and gets us on the tour. Like you mentioned how it kicks off, with the tour. That's like, what, 25 minutes into the movie? Like, I mean, it's so, all of those first scenes do so much heavy lifting. They do so much work, and it feels natural. Right? Like, it just feels like you're learning things over the natural course of just watching these people. We learn about, you know, Grant's relationship to kids. We learn, about Nedry needing to, you know, set things up, and that first Dotson. Like, all that happens right there at the beginning. It just happens so efficiently.
Well, and a lot of it, sorry to interject, but
please do.
A lot of what is genius here, and I don't know, I think we give credit to Crichton, is that Tim is a dinosaur aficionado, so he's constantly talking with Alan about dinosaurs. And early we see Alan talking about dinosaurs, but what the scene really is for the audience is he's scaring the little boy who said, that doesn't look very scary, but what we learn in that scene is crucial for when the velociraptors are out and loose in the park. And so it deals its exposition out in a way that feels very, very natural, and it's hard for some movies to do that when there's so much jargon.
Well, and
I love, go ahead. I love Grant so much in this movie, like the whole, like, he's, you know, he doesn't like kids at the beginning, but of course he grows into this protector role, and that's where he starts really. And the part where Lex is like, he left us, and he goes, but that's not what I'm gonna do. And just stares at it and everything. That's where you first, I think that's where you really fall in love with his character, is that part right there and everything. Anyway.
Yeah, it's incredibly efficient. You know, Jeremy, you mentioned the foreshadowing that's happening. Like, it's all over the place, whether it's Grant touching the LIDAR machine and it going staticky, you know, or his seatbelt not working and him having to tie it off, you know, on the helicopter ride over. Just all that stuff. And I wasn't kidding in the recap about how refreshing it is to see a cold open like that that isn't in medias res. Like every movie, it seems like, wants to start in the middle or start at the end so that you can get some action and then get to the boring setups, you know, part. And Spielberg's like, I can create a whole new cold open scene that is efficiently getting us information we need that's going to do that job without having to, you know, pull something from later on. It's just, he's so good. He's also so subtle. He doesn't feel the need to really punch his jokes too hard. There's this beautiful moment where Nedry puts the Barbasol shaving cream on a piece of pie, and it looks just like whipped cream. And you know somebody's going to end up eating Barbasol on their piece of pie. But you know what Spielberg doesn't do? Show somebody biting into that piece of pie with whipped cream, where other more lazy movies would make sure the audience got that joke. And it's so subtle. It's such a throwaway. You just see it, you know, happen, and there are just several moments like that. The genetic code that's shining on the dinosaur, the Velociraptor, so towards the end is just, I don't know. Spielberg's brilliant, and he's on display in this movie. It's so good.
And I have yet to not get chills on the when the dinosaurs rule the earth sign falling down as T-Rex roars. It's so basic and simple, and maybe even, I don't know, what do you want to call it? Like cheesy even, but it's so good. It's so good. Let's talk about that Triceratops for a second.
Yes, please. Let's do.
So they make it, they like, I don't know. They imply strongly that the dinosaurs are eating the poisonous plants. But then they find out in the dino droppings that they aren't. Now, is the answer to them getting sick the lysine thing?
No, it's the stones that they use for digestion. They swallow stones for digestion, and the stones are rubbing up against the plants that are there to look pretty.
The even stones?
Yeah, so like digestion. So some animals will swallow stones to help in the digestion process in the stomach. It just, that's how it works with lots like reptiles and different things. So... so anyways, that's the answer.
Is that something you've read into, or is that something
that's book? I think it might be in the book.
Explicitly in the movie, because
I don't think it's explicitly in the movie. I don't think it is.
The movie doesn't explain that at all. I always thought the lysine contingency was always the thing, because it's every 6 weeks. It's not just like it's not like a few days it happens, and then there's like a 3 week period, and then it's like another 2 week period. It's every 6 weeks. It's like clockwork. They are getting sick. So I don't even know if that would have anything to do with swallowing rocks, but I always thought that the lysine contingency was what sort of like made them sick, and then they had to get the infusion of it to stay healthy or whatever, and around that 6 weeks period, that's when they finally infuse them again. But of course, that wouldn't be a big mystery if that was the case. So I don't know. It's one of those things, that's one of those movie mysteries that they just, here's what's happening. We don't have an answer for you. We're too busy to get into the Nedry and the T-Rex part. So
yeah, that's at least what I remember from the book. But yeah, actually I can't guarantee where I remember that from, but I remember that's how the problem seemed to,
I read the book solve. After the movie, and I don't remember the book much. Well, I do remember that the book was different. That was way different.
It is very different. The other shot I have to mention in the kitchen is the reflection shot. Where the Velociraptor is heading straight towards Lex, it looks like just straight at her and bonks the setup and payoff for that is so perfect. He gives away the exact amount of information to not make you realize what's going on, and then go of course, you know, at the end. It's just, I don't know, it's just a perfect setup and payoff.
I've never seen a movie have more trivia notes than this one on IMDb. But one thing I wrote down was that scene in the kitchen took 2 weeks to film. And I think a lot of people forget how tedious making movies can be sometimes.
Oh my God, man. It's insane. I have very, very little experience on movie sets. I was on the Last Castle set, and like, I was sitting there just going, wow, this really takes a long time to do a scene, doesn't it? Like, they're shooting certain things that last 5 minutes in the movie for like a week, you know. So like, yeah, exactly. Like, anytime you see anything like some huge set piece thing, you know that took freaking forever for them to do it. So okay, let's get to our super secret double feature.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Don't make me go first.
I won't. I'll go first this time. This has some actual synergy with the stuff that we've been all the other stuff that we've been talking about in this movie. I have another movie from 1973. It's Westworld. It's the Michael Crichton written and directed amusement park movie where the robots go crazy, and has one of the best Simpsons episodes ever, by the way, if you've ever seen that, the Itchy and Scratchy Land one.
Nothing can possibly go wrong.
But yeah, Westworld, I think, goes along with this one. It also stars Richard Benjamin from the aforementioned Last of Sheila, but Yul Brynner is like the main star in Westworld. But I think this, you get into the Michael Crichton land here with this one, Michael Crichton world, with this and Jurassic Park, amusement parks run amok, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, see, we could very easily could have repeated my Martian thing here, because the top one on my list, what I would have said if I'd have gone first, could very well have been Westworld is the perfect one, but I'm going to go with something else. I would have stolen your thunder. I am actually going with I wanted the theme for me to be going somewhere you expect to be fun and interesting, and then all hell breaking loose. And I'm going with Jordan Peele's Us. And, you know, I could have gone with Jaws. I love the Westworld pick because that's obscure. I almost went Poseidon Adventure, but I ended up thinking Us was, you know, going to basically be the horror, straight horror element to pair with the fun horror of Jurassic Park. And there's a lot of parallel themes and stuff in there, too, I think you could pick at in conversation. So that's what I chose.
All right. Okay. All right. This is for next week. The next week's homework. It's my turn again, and because Jeremy has wanted us, Aaron and I, to come up with something that's streaming everywhere, I had to do a good search for something that I really loved and is on a bunch of streaming services, and man, did that take fucking forever. But I did find a movie that, in fact, was going to be a part of the I had it as a nominee for one of my comedies of the decade selections. It's A Fish Called Wanda from 1988. Fish Called Wanda is just a hilarious movie. Kevin Kline won the Oscar for this one. Jamie Lee Curtis is great in it. John Cleese, hilarious in it. Michael Palin, of course. You got like two-fifths of the Monty Python troupe in this movie. But this movie is so funny and so good, and it's streaming nearly everywhere. Like, I mean, not Netflix, but like it's on Tubi. I believe it's on Amazon. If you've got an Amazon subscription, it's like several other different streaming possibilities. And I love this movie. So let's go with that one. And I will do this for you, Jeremy, for a while. And then I'm going to stop because.
So let me clarify. It's just bad timing. I have like four or five movies that aren't streaming that people will have to pay $2.99 or $3.99. And every time I go to pick one of those, it ends up that you guys had just picked one that they would have to pay for. It's just bad timing. And so I requested a week or two of you guys picking
one
that would have to be rented and bump it off my list. There are two or three I'm dying to talk about on this show, and they're just apparently never going to go to streaming. And so I appreciate you very much doing that research. And I have not seen Fish Called Wanda in 15 years, and I am dying
to see it
again.
I'm excited.
You've seen this, Aaron?
Yes. Yeah. This is a great comedy.
Yeah. So that will be the homework for next week. All right. that's going to do it for this week. Once again, chat, thank you for coming out and watching us be goofballs for about an hour. Really love you guys coming out. Seemed like we had more than usual. Maybe it's because of the big movie we picked. I don't know. and yeah, it could be one of those type of things. But anyway, that's going to do it for this week. We will see you next time. See ya.
See you guys.
Bye. Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia at cinemasins.com.
We got our Christmas decorations down today.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
Wow,
March 11th.
That was fast. That was fast.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
I'm cranked. I cranked.
Nice.
So Jeremy last night was like, are you going to go see when you're in New York? Because I'm seeing Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yeah.
So that's going to be awesome. And he goes, are you going to see Othello with Denzel Washington and Jake Gyllenhaal, too? And I was like, well, I haven't even heard of this show.
The land of love. Home of the free and the brave. Is it 81 in Virginia? You get on that and you're like, okay, got to get through Virginia. And like 9 hours later, you're still in Virginia.
Yeah, Virginia never fucking ends, man.
This is by the way, our version of the Californians. This is the Tennesseans talking about how to get to the East Coast.
Yeah, you get on the I-40 and then you go down to 81.
I didn't come here to do trigonometry, okay? I just came here to talk about being 6 hours away from you. That's all.
Right.
Yeah, we used to take the family drive down to Orlando from Michigan, you know? And so Ohio was always the biggest chunk of that. And it was just like, are we out of Ohio yet? Can we please be out of Ohio now?
Yeah, you can only imagine what it's like for people who are driving over Texas. You know, like they have to drive, you know, over Texas to get to some place. Like, and you know, there's probably several people out there who do it constantly.
Oh yeah,
they have to go from East Texas to New Mexico or something like that. You know, and it's like, Jesus Christ, this never ends.
We drove a lot in Alaska, but not nearly. You know, like barely covered like the bottom section of it, even though we drove a ton. But with something like that, at least there's like glaciers and mountains and, you know, glorious, you know, lakes. And it's just like everywhere you look is like natural beauty. You know, you travel through Ohio and it's just like, ugh.
Yeah.
There's another Taco Bell. You know, like what am I looking at?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Guardrails and concrete, man.
It is.
You can't play the cows game in Ohio. You guys ever play the cows game?
Bury your cows? Did you play bury your cows?
We didn't call it that, but you count the cows on your side of the car.
Yes.
And then if you hit a cemetery on your side of the car,
bury
you
your,
lose
cows.
All your cows.
Yes.
Yeah. Nope. I didn't play this game.
I wonder how many other things you and I share like that from not only Midwest upbringing, but Nazarenedom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I think I made a joke about Rook once and you were like,
oh, my goodness.
Background.
Yeah. No, it's to this day, if we play cards with my parents, we play with Rook cards.
That's wild.
So, yep.
I like Rook. It's a fun game. I never understood why they thought we couldn't gamble with Rook.
Like, it's more symbolic, right? Like, my mom talks about it. Her dad was a gambler. Before he became a Christian or whatever. And so for her, there is some, like, you know, actual symbolic to the face cards and kind of them being in that environment or whatever. But you know, so many things. I mean, the movie thing was supposedly because movie houses were, you know, of ill repute, you know, back in the 20s or whatever. And I don't know. Making rules, it's just, legalism is just so ugly. It just turns ugly so fast. So, yeah. I had a cousin. We were at a Pacers Pistons game, and in Indianapolis, and he was like, "Hey, want to play pennies?" And I was like, "What's pennies?" And he's like, "Well, you pick your team, and then when they're on offense, you say score or not. And if you're right, I have to give you a penny, and then I have the other side of the court." Anyway, just a silly little gambling game.
Ooh, was that the game where Ron Artest like went into the stands and like caught everybody?
No, that was at the Palace.
I was going to say that was at
the Malice at the Palace.
I'm about to say you buried the lead there, Aaron.
yes, I have a scar to this day from where I punched Ron Artest. But
that's right.
No.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.